Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your host is Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor and founder of the Chalcedon Teacher Training Institute.
I have been involved in pro-life work since soon after I became a Christian. My husband and children have been active in being a voice for the unborn, with the children starting at a very early age and continuing to this day. I served in an unofficial organizing capacity with other women in my county and was involved in raising funds and awareness and helping women who needed support during their pregnancies. I even had the honor of being two of these women's labor coaches and witnessed the birth of their daughters. Back in early 1990, I received a luncheon invitation at one woman's house. She said it was just an opportunity for four of us women to get together and brainstorm, since the others were also active in pro-life work. Since kids were invited, my son, daughter, and I went, expecting a casual afternoon. As soon as I got there, I noticed that of the four of us women, two were dressed up much more than the third woman and myself. It was then I was told that a reporter from the local NBC affiliate was going to be there shortly with a camera crew to discuss our reaction to the release of RU486, the chemical abortion pill. Caught off guard by the surprise announcement, I was also a bit stymied, as this was my first introduction to this subject, and I felt completely ill-prepared to make any worthwhile comments. Since then, I have acquired considerably more information on the process of ending a pregnancy by means of taking a series of pills. My guest today is Dr. George Delgado, who has dedicated a considerable amount of his time, energy, and resources helping women who regret their decision and wish to reverse the effects of RU486. He is the president and founder of the Steno Institute. Since 2005, he has been the medical director of Culture of Life Family Services in San Diego, California. He is also the founder of the Abortion Pill Reversal, APR program, now called Abortion Pill Rescue. The program provides a medical protocol, a safe one, to reverse the effects of the drug mifepristone, which is now used in over 70% of the 1 million annual abortions in the U.S. Since 2008, over 5,000 women have given birth to healthy babies thanks to the use of the APR protocols developed, studied, and promulgated by Dr. Delgado and his team. Thanks for joining me today, Doctor.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Many are aware of the various procedures that have been in use by groups like Planned Parenthood since the supposed legalization of abortion after the Roe v. Wade decision. But many aren't aware of the number that I mentioned, that 70% of the abortions that take place in the U.S. involve this procedure. Explain, if you would, how that drug works, the protocol involved, and why the abortion industry has focused on this particular method when they relied on other methods for the last 30, 50 years.
Sure. So mifepristone is what we call a progesterone antagonist. Before I talk about that, it's important to know what progesterone does. Progesterone is a natural hormone. Its name tells what it is. It's an acronym, actually, progestational steroid quinone. The key parts of that acronym, of course, are progestational. That means that this hormone is essential for maintaining the pregnancy. Women who have very low levels of progesterone will miscarry pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy. What does the progesterone do? Well, it does several things. The most important things for our discussion is that the progesterone acts in a way like a biological superglue, causing adherence of the maternal part of the placenta, which is called the decidua basalis, to the baby's part of the placenta, which is called the chorion. And that adherence has to be very, very tight so that there can be exchange of nutrients, oxygen, and water from the mother to the baby, and exchange from waste products from the baby to the mother to go out and to go out of the baby. The progesterone also does other things, including keeping the uterine muscle very relaxed. The uterus is essentially a sac made of muscle. And of course, it starts out as a very small sac, but as the baby grows inside the uterus, it has to stretch and stay very pliant. You can't have you don't want contractions during the pregnancy. You want contractions at the end during the labor. The progesterone is a big, important player in keeping the uterine muscle nice and relaxed. Additionally, it keeps the opening of the uterus, which is called the cervix, closed like a biological valve, so that the outside world has nothing to do with the inside world, because the inside world is a sanctuary the baby needs and should be protected from the outside world. Progesterone also does other things with milk-producing cells of the breast, but that's not that as important for our discussion today. Now, mifepristone, on the other hand, is a progesterone receptor blocker. And what does that mean? It means that it blocks the receptors that are activated by progesterone so that the progesterone can't do its good things. One of the analogies I like to use for this is a lock and key. Think of the key as being the hormone progesterone and the lock being the receptor. And that key goes into the lock, turns the lock, and you are allowed to open a door. And opening the door is analogous to all of the good hormone effects of progesterone, such as keeping the placenta well adhered to the lining of the uterus. All of us have had the experience once or twice in our lives where it's been very frustrating when we had a key that fit into the lock and we thought was the correct key, but then it didn't turn the lock. In fact, it was a false key. And what's it doing when it's not turning the lock? It's essentially blocking that lock from being activated by the true key. And so when that lock is blocked by the false key, you don't get the door opening, you don't get the hormone effect. And that's when the placenta can then separate from the lining of the progesterone and cause the preborn baby to die from lack of nutrition, oxygen, and hydration.
Okay,
That's how
is
the
mifepristone used for
mifepristone works.
anything positive?
It actually can be, it's also approved for a condition called Cushing's syndrome. Cushing's syndrome is a condition of excess glucocorticoid hormones like cortisone. And because the mifepristone also blocks cortisone receptors, in addition to blocking the progesterone receptors, it can be used quite effectively for Cushing's syndrome. And it is approved for that when other treatments have not worked.
Is Cushing's syndrome related in any way to pregnancy, or this is just a totally different thing?
It's a totally different thing. And there are also some very early studies of using mifepristone to treat different cancers that have been unresponsive to other therapies. So we're very, very excited about that, that this drug that has been used for such evil things is now being put to good use.
Okay, so just to get my head around this. Somebody understood how mifepristone worked and decided, this might be a good way to kill babies.
Indeed, yes. And in fact, if you look at the history of when mifepristone was first discovered, well, actually, when the it actually goes back a little bit before that, when the company in France called Russell-Ucleff first synthesized the progesterone receptor, they first were able to make that receptor and identify it. One of the first things they did was to start on a hunt to find a chemical that would block that receptor. So they realized very early on that if they could block that progesterone receptor, they would have a chemical abortion drug. And they went on a very fast developmental chase to find that. And they did. And they synthesized progesterone soon thereafter. And then it was within 10 years that they got it, got the animal studies and the human studies and got it approved. So they knew they were onto something, first studying the progesterone receptor. And then when they got the synthesized the mifepristone molecule.
Just to get this clear, they did animal studies to make sure that the unborn animal inside the animal would die.
That's right. They first did studies in rats that demonstrated that the mifepristone was very effective at terminating the pregnancies of these rats and killing all the preborn pups. And that so they had this was these studies were done in Japan. They had one group that got mifepristone only, and then they had another group that got mifepristone plus progesterone. And they demonstrated, yes, that the two, the mifepristone and the progesterone, were competing against each other. And even actually before the rat studies in test tubes, they were able to demonstrate that the mifepristone and the progesterone competed against each other, and when they raised the concentration of the mifepristone, then called RU46, that it would win the battle. When they raised the concentration of progesterone, it would win the battle. So they very clearly demonstrated they were competing for the very same receptor, the progesterone receptor.
Now, the work that you have done actually makes use of the reality that if you up the progesterone, you can nullify the effect of the mifepristone. Was that ever shared with people in terms of, well, if somebody changed their mind, this could reverse it, or was that pretty much kept undercover?
You're talking about the
The
test tube studies
studies.
that they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was, they published that, but it was never advertised as a possible way to reverse the a chemical abortion. No, they just kept it in their basic science. They used it for, drug approval, and that was it. Then they filed it away.
I see. So, whenever this actually took place, I imagine there were a lot in the pro-life community that were, what do we do about this? So, talk about the journey that you went on and others in terms of how to develop the protocol that I mentioned earlier.
Well, our protocol was really a response to a woman, well, two women. There are two isolated cases that that happened about a year and a half apart. One was in 2006, one was in 2008. The 2006 case was Dr. Matthew Harrison in North Carolina. The 2008 case was myself helping a woman in El Paso, Texas. And we both came upon the same solution independently. So I could tell you about my story. I was seeing patients in my San Diego office, and I got a phone call from Terry Palmquist, who had has a website, Lifesavers, and she also carries a phone around with connected to a 1-800 number. While she's sidewalk counseling in Bakersfield, California, she gets calls from women all over the country seeking help. And on this particular day, she got a call from a woman named Erin, who was in El Paso, Texas, who was interested in reversing her chemical abortion. And so she called Terry, and Terry didn't know how to help her. So she called me because in the past she had called me asking when she had medical questions about different pro-life issues. And I said, "Well, Terry, I've never heard of anyone trying to stop or reverse their chemical abortion with mifepristone, but let me give this some thought," because I knew a lot about how mifepristone worked because I'd studied it since even before it was approved in the U.S. in the year 2000. So I knew exactly how it worked by blocking progesterone receptors. I also had a lot of experience using progesterone in pregnancy with women who had low progesterone levels and were having cramping or spotting, a situation we call threatened miscarriage. And in those cases, if they have low progesterone levels, you can supplement the progesterone and save the baby. So I'd done that quite a few times because of my knowledge of progesterone. So I thought to myself, well, perhaps, although these women may have normal progesterone levels, functionally, their progesterone is not working the way it should because its effect is being blocked by the mifepristone. So I thought to myself, knowing how these keys and false keys work, that maybe if we raise the concentration of the progesterone, it could outcompete the mifepristone at the receptor site, and perhaps we could save the baby. So I told Terry, "Well, I have a plan, but let me see if I can find someone in El Paso who could treat this woman." And I found a physician, Dr. Jonalyn Bellacura, who had progesterone in the office, had received the same NAPRO technology training than I had. And I presented her, I came up with a protocol on the fly, and I presented that protocol to her. She agreed to treat the patient. We put the two of them in communication, and that was it. I went on my way seeing patients that day. Well, a couple of weeks later, I got a call from Dr. Bellacura that telling me that she had treated the patient and that the baby was still alive in the mother's uterus. So I was very happy to hear that. And then throughout the pregnancy, I got more reports until finally I learned that she had delivered a very healthy baby girl.
That's great. So I've been told that if someone regrets taking the first dose and they contact Planned Parenthood, they're told that it can't be reversed. You've already started the process. If you stop the process, you could actually give birth to a medically deformed baby, a child with handicap. How true is that?
It's absolutely false. And I've heard many anecdotes of women hearing the same thing when they've called a Planned Parenthood or whatever abortion center they actually use. And they're often given this misinformation. So the people at Planned Parenthood are either not keeping up with the medical literature and haven't shown, read our articles, which and actually our 2018 article is now the largest case series of women who took mifepristone and then delivered babies that's ever been studied. And this showed that there's no increased risk of birth defects. And in fact, when you look at other literature and look at the practice bulletin put out by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they have a practice bulletin on chemical abortion. And in there, they state that mifepristone does not cause birth defects. And there are no, and all the other published literature show is very supportive of that mifepristone does not cause birth defects. And we know that progesterone has been used safely in pregnancy for over 50 years, so that it does not cause birth defects. So the people that Planned Parenthood and these the other abortion centers either are not reading the medical literature and aren't up to date, or they're simply lying. I don't know which one it is, but one or the other.
Right.
So women are getting misinformation when they do call them first.
So, just for curiosity's sake, let's say a woman were to take the first dose, but not take the second dose and not have any involvement with someone trying to help her save the pregnancy. What would be the result?
So our 2017 study that was a very comprehensive study by Dr. Mary Davenport, where she looked at all of the early mifepristone studies before they introduced the second drug in the cocktail. And she found that at best, you can expect 25% to survive, babies to survive if they've been exposed to mifepristone and nothing else is done. So that's what we can tell anybody who's interested in that fact.
Right, but how would the woman get rid of what was inside her uterus?
Well, so if the baby if the preborn baby dies, which 75% or more of the time it will, then 60 to 80% of the time she'll go on to start contractions on her own and will expel the remains of the baby. But 20 to 40% of the time, if she doesn't take that second drug, misoprostol, then she'll have the remains of the preborn baby staying inside the uterus, and then she'll have to somehow seek medical attention, either by taking the second drug or by having a surgical DNC.
Okay, so if this cocktail, I think it's an interesting term, but I guess that's the medical term for it. After you take the first one, how long before you take the second one to successfully kill your child?
So they're generally told to take the second drug 24 to 48 hours after taking the first drug. Generally, it's usually these days they tell them 24 hours.
And what's the experience then the woman has after she takes the second dose? Does she get any help from these abortion providers?
Well, actually, they give some instructions on a sheet of paper, but pretty much the woman is on her own and left to abort her baby in the privacy of her own bathroom, often totally alone, forlorn. And she will have very significant contractions, pretty significant pain, like very, very bad menstrual cramps, and very significant bleeding, generally bleeding that is much in excess of her usual period. So she will bleed a lot, she will cramp a lot, and then she will pass her preborn baby, unfortunately, often into the toilet where it is a very undignified end of the journey for that preborn baby who has been first, life has been ended, and then has been unceremoniously deposited into the toilet of a bathroom.
And so, am I correct in assuming then that toilet gets flushed?
Generally, that toilet gets flushed, yes.
What do you think that says about our groundwater if this is the procedure that people are using? What would be the effect of that over lots of people doing this? The statistic was 70%.
Yes. So this is is an unknown risk and hazard to our drinking water, to our sewage system, not to mention the ethical dilemma of all of these preborn human bodies being just dumped into the wastewater. So we don't know what effect this is going to have on the health of everybody else. And of course, this has not been studied because all the big abortion, the medical abortion complex would not want this to be studied because they don't want anyone to question their narrative that abortion is a great good for all women, which is what they say.
Yes, safe and legal. So there have been some hindrances, by the abortion industry in terms of even letting the protocol that you've established along with others to be known about. Talk a little bit about the pushback.
Yeah, we've had severe pushback from big abortion. That would be Planned Parenthood, ACLU, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, American Medical Association, and then some leading figures in abortion research, Dr. Mitchell Crennan and Dr. Daniel Grossman, among others. So they've minimized, ridiculed, attacked all of our research, and have denied that some women may want to change their minds. They have said that it's rare, when actually studies done by some of these people themselves have shown that it's not rare that women have regrets, and that a significant percentage of women would want to continue their pregnancies if their chemical pregnancies are not effective. And so they've pressured obstetrician gynecologists into not treating women with abortion pill reversal protocols, even when women come asking for it. And so they've created a great an ambiance of intimidation and of fear, so that doctors don't want to go against the party line, even though they know that there's something that's safe and effective to help women who choose this. We're not forcing abortion pill reversal on anyone. We're just offering it to women who reach out to us who say they want to reverse their chemical abortions.
Yeah. So have you personally been threatened or had smear campaigns launched against you?
Yeah, fortunately not threatened, but definitely smear campaigns launched against me, calling this junk science and saying that I and others are misleading women, and that we're not helping women, that we're harming women, which is absolutely untrue.
Right. And from what I understand, I don't know the status of the case. The Attorney General of California was going after pregnancy centers that made this treatment available, saying that they're misleading women and hurting women when there's no evidence to that effect. It's just a propaganda campaign.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The Attorney General of California has sued both Real Options Obria Clinic in the Bay Area, as well as Heartbeat International, which now runs the Abortion Pill Rescue Network. And it's sort of as a follow-up to that, Culture of Life Family Services, where I'm the medical director, we have actually preemptively sued the state of California because this intimidation tactic that they have employed by suing Real Option Obria and Heartbeat International has a chilling consequence, and it could affect us because we are now threatened with being fined daily if we partake in abortion pill reversal treatments, and our First Amendment rights to free speech are being hindered by their intimidation tactics. And we feel that they're trying to infringe on our rights to practice medicine in an ethical manner, in a Hippocratic manner, which following the Hippocratic Oath, which tells us that we should do what's best for patients. We should not kill our preborn patients. That's part of the Hippocratic Oath.
Yes. So I've spent a lot of time on your website. You have testimonials of people who have benefited from your work, but you also ask people to donate. What would they be donating to, and how would they do it if, as a result of hearing this, they want to get involved?
Yes, so they can go to stenoinstitute.org, stenoinstitute.org, and there they can, there'll be a donate button on the homepage, and they can also learn more about our institute. Our institute exists in order to increase awareness, education, and research around abortion pill reversal. And this is very critical for several reasons. One is that we want women, if they find themselves in a situation where they've taken mifepristone and changed their mind, to already know that there is an option called abortion pill reversal, so they don't have to hunt things down on the internet. We want them, first of all, to know that option exists. Number two, we want anybody who might be in that woman's sphere of influence, anybody who might be a confidant of that woman, to already know about it. So that if that woman reaches out for help saying, hey, I want to stop my chemical abortion, her friend might say, oh, you know, I've heard about abortion pill reversal already. And so they already know about it. Secondly, we want to educate legislators so that they're very well informed. So when they pass laws that possibly could support abortion pill reversal, laws that maybe require abortion centers to give a good informed consent, to tell women, if you ever change your mind about this chemical abortion you're about to start, there is abortion pill reversal that's available. And next, about research, so that We have more research that one can refine our protocols. Number two, though, then again, can increase the general knowledge of physicians in particular. So the physicians are confident that if a patient calls them, they can recommend abortion pill reversal. So they know, oh, yeah, I've read about those studies. Those are well done studies. And they show that abortion pill reversal is safe and effective and that some women do change their minds, as well as having the research base to support policy making and as well as legislation. So all those things are so important to increase awareness, increase education, increase research, so that abortion pill reversal will be front of mind for anybody who changes her mind and will feel confident that this is a very safe option to save her preborn baby, so that we can help women know that they can be transformed from one who would abort her baby to one who would now be the savior of her baby.
Interestingly enough, the people who call themselves pro-choice are really not interested in this choice. And so I imagine the fight to have them give informed consent will probably be a substantial one. Two questions before I let you go, because my listeners should know you had a full day of working in your office and you agreed to speak to me at the end of the day. How did you get the name the Steno Institute? What is that?
So Steno is named after a 17th century Danish physician and scientist, Nicholas Steno. And it's very interesting to know that all of us have two ducts in our cheeks that are called the parotid ducts that drain the parotid gland. And when you think about sucking on a lemon drop, you often feel saliva coming out of the inside of the cheek. That's saliva coming from the parotid duct. The other name for the parotid duct, because it was discovered by Nicholas Steno, is the duct of Steno, or the English translation is Stenson's duct. And Steno is the Latin version of his name. I thought it just Steno had a better sound to it. So I wanted to name it after him because he was a very inquisitive physician and scientist. He also is known as the father of modern geology and paleontology. The whole concept of rock stratification was developed by him. He was the one who first discovered fossils. And then when he went to Southern Europe from Denmark in order to be a court physician for some nobility, he then was became more and more interested in theology. And then he abandoned his studies of science and went full force into theology, and eventually became a bishop and was a very, very holy bishop who would donate, sell some of his possessions and donate money to the poor, and would go out in terrible weather to go visit his flock. And so I thought he was a perfect blend of faith and reason and a very ethical role model. And so I decided to name the institute after him, Nicholas Steno.
Very good. I was curious about that the whole time. And you should probably add that to the website because I couldn't find it anywhere unless I just wasn't looking in the right place.
Yeah, I think we do have a page on him, but I'll look it up to make sure it's still
Okay.
there.
The other thing I want to ask you is that this is more than just a professional concern. This is a personal concern for you as well, because as you pointed out, you get called names and your reputation is impugned. What motivates you to keep going in this pursuit?
What motivates me now is what motivated me the first time I got into this in 2008, when I got that phone call from a woman who was looking for help. And that's really all I need to motivate me, because they're asking for help. I know that I can provide help. And I know that this is worthwhile because I know that human life is a precious gift. And so, in order to be part of saving a life, and especially helping a mother save the life of her own child, I can't think of anything that I've done in my career that gives me as much gratitude and satisfaction. So that's all I need to keep me motivated, and that keeps me from letting the naysayers get me down. I'll always
Okay.
remain positive because of that.
All right. Last question. First of all, I'm going to give the website stenoinstitute.org, and I suggest people go there. Obviously, you would appreciate if people were so led to donate to help you do all the things that you said. What else do you think people can do, especially young people, in terms of being part of this whole process of letting people be aware. Any suggestions in terms of how the average guy can do something about this?
Sure, I would ask the average guy or gal to become well informed about chemical abortions, how prevalent they are, how chemical abortions take place, how that they're not simple and clean the way they're made out to be. There's a lot of suffering in it, a lot of suffering by herself. And secondly, be well informed about abortion pill reversal. Know about the Steno Institute website, as well as abortionpillreversal.com, so that if you come across a friend who has started the chemical abortion process and changes her mind, you can be there to be supportive and to give that advice and to go on that website and talk to the hotline nurse and connect your friend with her so that she can start the abortion pill reversal process. So I think increasing knowledge and being influential amongst your sphere, again, your sphere of influence is so important, all of you out there, that there are many people that you touch, you can have an influence, you can have a very positive influence about spreading the good word that women can have a second chance at choice if they so choose.
Very good. Well, listeners, I hope you make use of the website to inform yourself and do just what Dr. Delgado suggested. outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com is how you reach us. And Doctor, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.